This is Jeff Machota recording another Nature's Table archive project. It is Tuesday, February 21st, 2017. We're in the basement of Smith Music Hall in the office of Joel Spencer. And Joel, want to say who you are and what's up?
Well, thanks, Jeff, and thanks for us being able to do this. And I'm Joel Spencer, and I'm an assistant professor of music now here at the University of Illinois in jazz studies, and that basically encompasses teaching drum set lessons, working with combo, working with large ensemble, teaching jazz history in throughout the entire school year, so jazz history 1 and 2 courses, and a jazz listening 1 and 2. And what I love about it, it has so much, it has everything to do with where I started, what I became interested in, what really inspired me in terms of being a musician, being a drummer, and it's very close to being a performer, and knowing and feeling, you know, what it is that you do, you can share with people. But I started as a young kid playing, and I was just briefly here, moved by jazz. My parents were very interested in jazz.
You grew up in Chicago?
I grew up in Lockport, Illinois, southwestern suburb. And jazz for me is, when I heard it as a kid, I often talk about this, I was not only excited about it, but somehow I couldn't put it in these words, but I seemed to understand, or felt like I understood, that people were playing off the top of their heads. And I realized that everybody played differently. And everybody had their own sound. And the more my dad would, you know, play his Benny Goodman Sextet records and Count Basie records and Ellington and Dizzy Gillespie, big band, and these kind of things, I started to recognize who they were without him, after a while, telling me who they were. And I'd say, oh, that's the Benny Goodman Sextet, but that's Davy Tough playing drums. He plays lighter, and there's more of an easier feel compared to the driving sound of Gene Krupa, and so on and so forth. So,
did your parents play, or were they just, they were fans?
They were real fans. My mom comes from a musical family, but she didn't play. But my dad was basically, quote, a semi-pro bass player. He worked some really good gigs. His biggest gig was in the 60s, when Doc Severinsen would come to Joliet, my dad would get that gig. I would play with Doc. But my dad loved music and didn't consider himself to be a jazz bass player or anything, full-time bass player. In fact, my dad was an electrician as a tradesman. And so, but during the war, that is World War II, he loved the music and started collecting records. So his fun, every day after work, and when I was a kid, he would come home, have dinner, and he would play his records. And so in my household as a young kid, I heard Basie with Ella Fitzgerald. I heard the Duke Ellington Band. I heard Jimmy Smith records. I heard Benny Goodman Sextet records. And I just seemed to gravitate, for whatever reason, to the drums. So I started as a young kid, and by the time I got to high school, music and playing had become a major force in my life, and probably by the time I was a junior in high school, I had already determined, well, this is what I'm going to do, and I can't imagine doing anything else.
Was there, so this was in Lockport, was there the public school? Or?
This was in Lockport, and I went to Lockport Central High School, which I wasn't that interested in the band program. We had no jazz band. The program really didn't accentuate that style of music. As a matter of fact, I started, what I had was my record collection and an incredible private teacher, a guy by the name of Jim Salbago, who was a great drummer. The first time I heard Jimmy, my dad says, when he gets back off the road, you got to study with him. And I said, what's his name? And he says, his name's Jim Salbago. And I said, well, he must be good. He says, well, we're going to watch. He's on the Ed Sullivan Show tonight. And he was serious. And
playing with who?
It was a group called the Swingin' Lads. And then the Swingin' Lads in the 60s, that might sound like, oh, it sounds like a folk group. Sounds like the, the Christy Minstrel Singers or whatever they're called. No. This was a cutting-edge show group that was fast, furious, guys that could play, sing, and tap dance. That was like burning. And so the first time I heard my teacher had such a great influence on me was on the Ed Sullivan Show. And so I can remember he did, that did last about another year went by. It was time for me to move on to another teacher. Jim had moved to Chicago, and all I can remember is seeing him on TV. Well, as it turned out, at that point in time, I was in eighth grade at this time. I never met someone who was on TV. So my dad brought me down for my first lesson, walked in the studio, and I met him. I was speechless because I saw this guy on TV. How could it be that I'm now talking to him? But anyway, I got past that and realized he was a great teacher. So besides his input and all my record collection, by this time, the time I got to be a freshman in high school, I had a very elaborate record collection, and I had heard the likes of 50s John Coltrane. I had heard Miles Davis, mid-late 50s, hard bop music, that is. I had heard Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie, and all I could think about is playing music.
Where did you get those records?
I was inspired by my dad, but started reading Downbeat and started, you know, getting some information. I should say, I take that back. Eighth grade, I had some of those records. It wasn't until freshman in high school that I found and heard about Charlie Parker. But that's because I went to the Vandercook jazz camp during the summer. And I actually got to play in a jazz ensemble and started getting a little bit of some background. But probably the most inspirational moment of that era for me, I started getting a lot of work in the Joliet area in Chicago Heights and actually started earning a name as a drummer and started playing a lot of gigs with adult players. And
jazz gigs? Or
they were jazz gigs, commercial gigs. Those were the days when the late 60s, early 70s, a youngster, obviously you had to be 21 years old to drink, but you could be anywhere just as long as you weren't drinking, needless to say. I went to clubs and started sitting in, and my parents were very open to this, very like, this is great, this is what you want to do. And I also had an uncle of mine who didn't live a long life. His name was Al Piazza. In fact, my mom's brother, who was an incredible jazz accordionist. In fact, who else came up in...
You said jazz accordionist?
Yes.
Okay.
Played in the accordion, jazz. And as a young guy, he was on WJJD radio in Chicago, the Maxwell House Coffee Hour. There were always pictures at my uncle's house with him and people like Dean Martin, Jerry Lewis, various people that he had met in the music business. Well, to make a long story short, things didn't exactly work out. However, he was an incredible inspiration, but he had been an inspiration in that area to young musicians for a long time. In fact, there was a young tenor player from Plainfield, Illinois, that came up under my uncle's enthusiasm and under his wing by the name of Ron DeWar.
No,
so as my uncle as a kid told me about this great saxophonist from Plainfield, Illinois, by the name of Ron DeWar.
Huh.
So I knew about Ronnie long before I met him and I actually heard him. And I got to know the DeWar family, and by the time I was a sophomore, started working steady gigs, and with, of all people, Ron's youngest brother, Roger DeWar, who's a bass player, and it was Roger who heard me and started playing with really good groups. And it was because he brought me into the scene and he believed in me and said, you know, he thought, this kid can really play. So by the time I was a sophomore or junior, I was working a lot of gigs and with some really good musicians, played on a Channel 32 WFLD TV on the Mary D Show. Actually had some experience playing TV, playing with a jazz trio. In fact, with a guitarist by the name of Peter Budd, and I don't know whatever happened to him.
So you didn't go through the rock and roll drum phase at all?
No.
You weren't playing any like high school rock bands? You were straight into the jazz?
I was for a minute, but I had come up, honestly, and I enjoyed it with my friends. I came up with the Beatles, listened to the Rolling Stones. And I especially like Motown. And I especially like that feel And I dug groups like James Brown because of that pop from the drummer and what that was, that whole feel. I cared more for someone like Jimi Hendrix and Carlos Santana. I like, because they played solos, they stretched out. They reminded me of a jazz player. So I related to that more. So I had that, but I didn't spend a lot of time at all in playing rock at all as a drummer. I fell into jazz and I started working at such an early age, and probably the next important thing that happened to me, I, through Roger DeWar, on a steady gig, Ron came in. In fact, the U of I band just returned from Russia, and this would have been, I believe, I want to say December of 1969, so I would have been 15 years old. I'm playing a gig, and Ron came in and sat in. It's the first time I got to play with Ron, and that was an incredible experience. And all along, Roger always told me about, you got to hear my brother play. He can really play. Well, he was right. Yeah, he could really play. Could really knock it down, as we all know. Guy's a guru of jazz tenor saxophone. But it was Ron who said, you know, every summer we do this jazz camp at University of Illinois called Summer Youth Music. And we have a very strong jazz program. I think you'd be great. So I came down for a summer session. That would have been summer of 1970, where I met the likes of Ed Peterson, Eric Schneider, Ed being a great saxophonist who went to school here eventually, Eric Schneider, who's still a very close friend of mine, trumpet player Jeff Kay, who now lives in Los Angeles, pianist by the name of Fred Simon.
They were all in the ISYM?
Yeah, all of just packed. Michael Bard, who's a great musician who now has been in Portland for many years. Jeff Lindberg, who runs the jazz members now, the Chicago Jazz Orchestra. Jeff was here at this first camp. It goes on and on. The great New York bass player now, Steve Laspina, was a student from Wheeling. He was there. And it was really, I discovered the best young players in the state of Illinois, undoubtedly.
So you were still in high school.
Right, we were all in high school. And this was a summer camp for high school kids. And who was the director of the Jazz One band? John Garvey. So that summer, playing with these guys, and the direction and the talent level, and working like with someone like John Garvey, and the entire faculty, the entire staff involved, was U of I played in Garvey's band, which by this time was known as one of the great college bands in the United States, jazz bands. I mean, it was North Texas, there was Indiana with David Baker, and there was John Garvey with the U of I band. And that was it. It didn't take me long before I realized I got a really great start as a young player in the Chicago area, and a chance of playing a lot of gigs. I met, finally, all these young players that have the same interest and the same desires I have about music. I finally met them, and that was it. The next thing I was thinking about is going to the University of Illinois and with all these spectacular players and becoming involved with that and really carrying on and really learning, stepping up to the next levels of becoming a player. So it was that, and that truly changed my life, and I found that this was a place, and I'd like to think that we are still doing this. That is, we're intercepting young talent and hopefully doing everything we can to develop their talent as an artist. I always thought this was very much like this faculty. I think of our faculty very much as an artist colony faculty. And this town and the music scene very much as an artist colony. It was, I always thought it was a place you could be purely you, the way you play, and this was a place that could accept that because this place understood art. It wasn't about playing a certain way and fulfilling this and that and being the certain player so you could succeed either commercial venture or jazz programs where a lot of people sound the same. There can be really good programs. And there's a sameness because people aren't as open to that sense of individuality. So I felt this was a great place for me. And I could see it. When I'd hear the U of I band, all these different personalities in the band, when you'd hear them solo, everybody had this individual voice. And somebody like Garvey was a total individual and was a brilliant musician, I think a genius. Well, Harry Partch, who wrote Genesis of a Music, refers to Garvey as a conductor and a violist, as a genius. And I guess only a genius could convey the word and, you know, grant someone else genius status. So Harry Partch was a genius, I believe, as well. Garvey came up out of the Walden String Quartet, one of the greatest string quartets, I guess, in the 40s and the 50s. They came here, they became artists in residence. And so the jazz program here was headed by someone who was, a brilliant musician, certainly in his younger years, as I understand, one of the greatest violists in the country as a recitalist. So this had a very strong artistic background, and the teaching, the vision, and the musical creativeness came from somebody who was just a world-class musician. This is the person that shaped it. And as I understood, Garvey thought it would be great to have a jazz ensemble here and a jazz band, and was familiar with Ellington and Basie, I think especially Ellington, one of maybe John's most favorite band. And as I heard in the late 50s, there was a chance to do this, and he did it right here in Smith 25, as I understand, and basically for no money. It was almost done on the sly, because I don't know that the music department at that point, or any music departments, were either had an openness or were understood the music or wanted that to be a part of the program. So Garvey would start producing this band and attracting, as it would be, a lot of great players. And then there were schools like David Baker at Indiana and the program at North Texas State. And so when I was in high school, those were almost seemed like the only great jazz programs. Now, what was starting to come up, of course, well, before there was Berkeley in Boston. There was truly a jazz school then.
When did Duar come down here, do you know?
If I have it right, I believe Ron was a freshman in 58 or 59.
Okay.
Which also, one of our dearest friends and one of our greatest talents in town, Don Heitler, I believe was in school a little earlier than that as a freshman here as a music major. But I can't. I must mention the saxophonist Joe Farrell, whose name was Joe Farantello, who, as it would be, was from Joliet, Illinois, right next to Lockport. Another tenor player that played with Uncle Al before Ron DeWar.
Really?
So my uncle had two tenor players that were incredible jazz players. That was my other teacher.
Did you have any big band experience before you came here?
I'm glad you asked me that question, because that's when I auditioned in the suburbs to get to Summer Youth Music. Those were the days you had to audition. Jazz camp was only for, quote, upperclassmen, junior and senior. And it was 2 weeks rather than one, and you had to audition outside the camp to get in it. Then once you got here, you auditioned again to be placed in, was it Jazz 1, Jazz 2, Jazz 3, whatever it was. So, because my school did not have any jazz at all, including a big band, not even a stage band or, quote, or a dance band. I did tons of practicing with big band records in my bedroom. My parents loved them. I put up with all this. I could just be me. Everything was okay that I chose to do with music. And I would be for hours, literally, playing along, especially with Count Basie records and Buddy Rich records. I was thinking, well, Buddy Rich, did you play along with his solos? Well, God, no. No one could do what he did. On top of it, but the other part of it, he had a lot of charts that had a lot of different action and catching a lot of orchestrations and fills. I practiced like the devil. So now it's going to sound like I'm bragging. I'm not, but I worked really hard, and I auditioned, and this first year at Summer Youth, I made the top band. And John Garvey said to me, "Well, Joel, you sound really good." And he had these nice compliments for me and said, "You must have a very accomplished jazz band at your school. What's the name of your school?" And I said, "Well, it's Lockport Central, and we don't even have a terrible jazz band at our school. We don't have one." And he said, "Oh, come on." I said, "I just listen to music and just practice." So the first time I ever played with a big band was playing with Garvey's Jazz One at Summer Youth, which was basically the shape of what was Allstate Jazz Band. So it was a wonderful opportunity. We all worked very hard, and knock on wood, that worked out for me. But those beginnings between my Uncle Al, my drum teacher, Jimmy Salbago, who I first heard on the Ed Sullivan Show, this was also damn exciting, and John Garvey and Ron DeWar, and meeting a lot of my peers that are still my close friends to this day, because we all started playing music together, and we still continue to play music. And many of us made a living out of this. That had everything to do with me finding out who I was and what I wanted to do. And as it turned out, I ended up, to this day, being a musician, playing drums, and that's what I wanted to do, I guess, since I was in fourth or fifth grade. I just never changed my mind.
Did you have brothers or sisters?
I have a brother, but he played some bass, played some trumpet, was in band. You know, we also came up in the band system in our grade school, junior high, and high school. My parents were very involved as band parents and all that kind of stuff. It was 12 months a year. But my brother eventually would not play, went to Lewis College, a private school, and got a degree in business, and eventually went to Miami Law School. And now he works in a law-like department for Burger King International and loves music, but he did not become a musician.
So what year was your freshman year here?
My freshman year here would have been 1972.
So outside of coming into the Garv, well, you weren't in the Garv band right off the bat, then, would you be?
No.
How many bands were there back then?
Back then, I want to say, were there three, were there four? I haven't thought about that in a long time. No one, well, with Garvey's situation, it was, as he called it, and part of this, I want to say part of the reason by what I'm about to describe existed. It's that horrible war, the Vietnam War, and there was that period when if you were a college student, and I believe if you were married, you could get a deferment and not have to go into the service. So I think one of the, I want to say, it's my opinion, but I think many would agree, University of Illinois, probably North Texas, Indiana, isn't it interesting that those top bands had people in their late 20s, some early 30s. So when I heard the U of I band as a high school kid, it didn't take me long to realize that these guys seem a bit older than like college age, and some seem significantly older and played like downright professional players. That kind of, at first I thought, so these are college players? This band sounds incredible. It sounds like a professional band. And Garvey would talk about it that way. That's because it was. And so when I came here, Garvey had what he called, because there were guys that were not in school that were in the band, that maybe at one time were in school, but still played in the band. Playing in Garvey's band was almost an occupation. And was sincerely, the talent level was extreme. Between, for example, Ron and Cecil Bridgewater. Come on. I know at one point, Dee Dee Bridgewater would sing with the band. Don Smith, the vocalist, who would go on to play with Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers as a pianist and a vocalist. It was deep. Howie Smith, Ron DeWar, Ken Ferrantino as the lead trumpet player, Jim Knapp, who was this genius writer. It was a band that was in another league. So that's what Garvey called the old pro band, who students and everyone could learn so much from. Damn it, he was right. I wouldn't have wanted it any other way. So really, when I made the band, and it was my time at U of I, and it was a great band, the second band, quote.
Did he lead that as well, or did...
He did lead that band as well, and at the time, so did Ron DeWar for periods of time. That was a hell of a great band. But I should say now, I failed to mention rhythm section players, and that band was, first Ron Elliston, who so sadly just passed away recently. But Ron Elliston was a brilliant player. Then followed by the likes of Jim McNeely.
So Ron played what?
Ron Elliston played piano.
Piano, okay.
And then after he left the band, Jim McNeely came in, and we all know what Jim McNeely has done as a professional. It's incredible, playing with the likes of groups like Ted Curson, Stan Getz, the Thad Jones Mel Lewis Orchestra. Mm-hmm. And he's, I believe, the conductor of the Danish Radio Orchestra, playing jazz, and is still now called the Vanguard Orchestra, Monday nights at the Village Vanguard. Jim still remains the pianist. So he's a genius player, he's a genius musician and composer, unbelievable. Then at the time when I first got here, a bass player by the name of Fred Atwood played bass, who eventually you would hear on a number of different records, but I remember as a young college player, and maybe high school, Super Sax. If you remember the group Super Sax,
yeah,
was a five-piece saxophone section that played Charlie Parker transcriptions. Fred Atwood. And then another brilliant bassist by the name of John Monahan via North Texas State was here for a long time. And an incredible musician. So unfortunately, would have a short life. I had John Monahan for a teacher in summer youth music working with a combo. He was absolutely brilliant, and he was someone who had obviously this incredible joy about playing music, and he was able to transfer that over to you and built just a real motivational space. And I absolutely loved working with him.
So at that point, you couldn't get a degree in performance, correct?
You could not get a degree in jazz performance. In fact, it wasn't until the school finally hiring someone like Chip McNeil, and it was Chip who developed the jazz programs and actually wrote the curriculums and actually put it into working order and actually creating a jazz degree major.
So what program were you in then?
Well, I started out as an applied percussion, and then knew what I wanted to do.
So that's classical?
Yes, that's basically classical and contemporary percussion ensemble. And I really enjoyed it, but that really wasn't my road. And I had a great teacher, Tom Siwi, who I'm thrilled. Now I teach here, and I want to believe, if I remember right, this was Tom's office that we're sitting in. So it's got a good feeling. So I ended up to be diversified as a jazz player. And it worked out great. It's really what I wanted to do. It's another interest that came up. And I never knew beforehand that I was interested in teaching until John Garvey gave me the opportunity to teach summer youth music and teach jazz and work with a combo. Maybe get to work with a big band. Work with rhythm section players. So I ended up getting my bachelor's in music education, the K-12 teaching certificate in the state of Illinois. Which, it was a lot of work, and I still...
And you did all that here.
I did all that here, and I still have a valid teaching certificate in the public school system in the state of Illinois. You never want to let that lapse. you'd be surprised, or maybe not surprised, what you'd have to do in coursework to get it back.
So what drum teacher did you study with here?
Well, I'm glad you asked that. because there was a great drummer playing in the top band, and that was Charlie Brogham. And Charlie could really put it right down the center with a big band, extremely creative, had an incredible ear, and I loved his small group playing. So for a while here, I studied with Charlie, but there really wasn't within the system jazz lessons on drum set. So a lot of ways between my teacher, Jim Salbago, and then Charlie Brogham, who I studied with just for fairly a short amount of time. My teacher, when it came to drum set, was my record collection and all of my most favorite drummers.
So outside of the Garve band and stuff going on here, what was Champaign Urbana like at that time for music?
I can remember on any given night and talking to my peers and saying, hey, did you hear? I think there's a session over at Ryan Elliston's house. And somebody said, you know, Ken Ferrantino, who lives on the west side of Champaign, I heard there's some guys playing out there tonight. Oh, really? Well, I'm going to go down to Chin's Restaurant because the Bridgewaters are featured there and they're playing at Chin's Restaurant, I believe, on 6th Street. And then you might find out, oh, well, you know, Jim McNeely and Charlie Brogham and John Burr, they're playing at the Red Herring downstairs in the coffee house. Gosh, what should we do? I want to be involved with all of this. This could be on a Tuesday night in the middle of just February and not a lot happening and maybe a lot of snow on the ground, for example. There was a connection with an audience here for jazz. There just was. And there were a group of older players that played jazz in town. But it seemed to be an interesting place, and I learned about this as a student at Summer Youth Music, that we'd have this thing where, you know, one of the teachers, a chaperone, would go with us, and we could go hear some great group of, you know, that had faculty members and go to some bar, some club in town and hear them. So from the first time I experienced Champaign-Urbana, University of Illinois, but the town itself, there's a lot of places to play and there was an audience that really enjoyed jazz. And I used to hear from people like Donnie Heitler, there was a series called Jazz As You Like It, if I have that name right. And that was in the student union. And that place could be packed with people listening. I just talked to my group this morning about maybe one of our most important goals as students, as young artists, are trying to create this communication between you and the student body. Look how many students are here. So many young, bright people in one place. Now, not that everybody's going to decide they love jazz, but at a school of, what, 40,000 plus students. So I'd like to think, being the dreamer that I am, that maybe there could be a couple hundred who could seriously like it and support it. Hey, what would Nature's Table would have been, although there were some nights, that was a different time, or the Post, if on any given night there's 100 or 150 people there to hear the music. We'd all be like, my God.
So did you have what was the first band that you formed outside of school? Did you have a combo while you were still in school?
Oh, yeah. I can remember specifically. It was a group with, there were two groups. One group I played with was with Jim McNeely, John Burr, bass player extraordinaire. Forgot to mention John's name, or maybe I did bring it up. Not enough. He's somebody that would leave here in about 1974, would join Buddy Rich's band, would leave Buddy Rich, would be playing with Stan Getz, I believe, for a while, would then be playing with Chet Baker, left Chet Baker's band, and then playing with Tony Bennett. You might, some night in the 80s, turn on The Tonight Show, Tony Bennett would be there, and there would be, of course, John playing bass with him. So I was in a group with Jim McNeely, John Burr, and Ron DeWar.
So you were the young guy.
Yeah, so was Burr. Burr and I were the young bloods, and there was Ron and Jim. And Jim was basically between us and Ron. as far as age. And the group was called the Gecko Lizard. And I believe that Ron came up with that name because, as Ron put it, the one thing you must fear about a gecko lizard, one snap from his tail could be your last day.
And what kind of tunes were you playing?
Something that underlined that. No, I mean, we're playing everything from hard bop to tunes by, you know, anyone from Rahsaan Roland Kirk, Jackie Byard, Herbie Hancock, even some of the tunes that appeared on some Elvin Jones records like Merry Go Round. I remember we were doing that tune. That was fun. The group, we liked a lot of the McCoy compositions. 4x5, Passion Dance.
So did you play at bars or restaurants, or was this...
Bars and restaurants we would play. And that was a group that we rehearsed a lot. And
do you remember some of the places you played?
Wow, I don't know that any of them are still here.
Well, I'm sure they're not.
Yeah. unfortunately. I mean, this, of course, was before Nature's Table. Mm-hmm. We used to play at, which Garvey's band played, at Trino's. And people say, what is Trino's? Well, on the corner...
I was here for
of,
that.
Oh, there you go. Of Oregon and Goodwin was Trino's, which is now what? Cafe...
It's Espresso Royale.
Espresso Royale. And the Bread Company was one long place called Trino's. And I'll get to...
It was still like that when I got down here.
Yeah. We would play there. That is, Gecko Lizard would play there. We also did a lot of traveling, and we played over in West Bend. We played in Lafayette, so Purdue, Notre Dame, up Bloomington. We used to play a club there called the Bluebird. That was a lot of fun. But before I get to even more of that, Garvey's band would play at Trino's, and it had become a steady Monday night. And it had been like that, quote, by the time I got here, like maybe for a decade. The band would start at 9 p.m., and they would set up on the south side, which, if you've been in the Bread Company and you walk around and you're gonna go to the John, in the day, if you were there, you would have walked right around the back of the trumpet section of the rhythm section of the band pointing northbound towards Cranard. And there was no advertisements, there were no signs, nothing in the paper. Everybody knew what Monday night was at Trino's. And by 8:30, you could hardly get in the front door or get to the stand. It was just packed. And that was every Monday night. And then, if you went down the street south, I have to remember this, which is now Timpone's. What was Timpone's?
The Thunderbird.
That's right. The Thunderbird. And upstairs, which is now this was a beautiful restaurant space, and not that it was that bad before, but upstairs, if you were to walk up the stairs and now you meet the hostess there and you're facing north where that window is, that would be the back of the trumpet section standing in front of trombones, saxophones, Garvey holding court, and there was Trino's.
The Thunderbird.
The Thunderbird, which was a great hang. You could end up wasting a lot of time as a student playing pinball and drinking beers at the Thunderbird. I never did that. And the band would play up there. So we played up there as a small group, Gecko Lizard. We played at the Red Herring on Sunday nights in the cafe downstairs. That had a jam session or a jazz group doing a formal performance every Sunday night. Then the next night, every Monday, was Trino's. And then Thunderbird, we played up there a bunch, and this was the very first group I was in when I first moved here. And that would have Dennis Luxian playing piano, John Burr, or Steve Laspina playing bass, myself playing drums, Jeff Kay was a wonderful trumpet player, Ed Peterson, and a lot of times Eric Schneider. Now I have to say, that was one hell of a good group for being freshmen and sophomores in college. That was a good sounding band.
And people were coming out to hear the gigs.
People were coming out to hear gigs, and were there, and you'd show up once again at Trino's or Thunderbird, if you got there in the middle of the first set, you may not be able to get in. This was normal. But having said that, we would try to find anywhere to play for an audience. So one of our favorite places, we'd go down the street past Cranard and go to Townsend Hall IRS dorms and in the lounge, unannounced. Another great tenor player who was here for a long time, great, Carl Lidrell, now teaches at University of Vermont. He was a terrific player. Wow. Carl and I and John Burr and Dennis Luxian, I believe, had a group together, and we would play at ISR, and we'd go to some dorms sometime, totally unannounced. No arrangement with the dorm or counselors or the front desk, and show up and set up, and I'm not exaggerating, in a half hour or 45 minutes, there might be 75 or 100 people hanging out listening to us. And it was like a serious concert. So what did this, you know, we could make money on some gigs, playing clubs, playing restaurants, what have you. But you learned outside of school there was this very vibrant scene and people formulating groups that were not groups that were built inside the school, inside the program, and playing for audiences. So a lot of us ended up having some really important experience playing in front of an audience before we left.
So when did you graduate?
Well, I didn't graduate. I got my bachelor's degree in spring of 78. I changed curriculums a couple times. I was so into playing. Sometimes I took shorter semesters. I think kids might wonder, how could you stay in school so long? It's expensive. Well,
it wasn't
there were
back
two
then.
Things. It just wasn't expensive. But by the time I was a senior, John Garvey, had given me a full ride scholarship in the music school and as a teaching assistant in jazz. And then I would go on from there into graduate school. But I would not complete graduate school that time around. But my last year as an undergraduate, graduate school for 2 years, it was wonderful. I had this scholarship, and back then, that literally paid for tuition, all fees, even your health insurance, and books at the bookstore, plus a stipend that easily paid your rent and food. It was great. It was such an artistic environment. At that time, I really didn't want to leave. I thought I was growing musically. I just really liked what was going on. And the talent kept, the place just kept attracting more and more talent. And eventually that would be the likes of people like Brad Wheeler and Mike Coker, for example. It just kept growing. It got to a point where I think the guys my age were we were the next generation after, or a third generation after Garvey's band. I mean, Garvey's band came on, I think, very strong mid-60s or so, which is a time, for me, I was a mid-60s, I was in junior high school. So I wasn't ready. Yeah, but that band was formulating, and then eventually, early mid-70s and so on, that's when I got in the band, and a lot of these young players my age that I talked about before, the program attracted them, and they ended up coming to school here.
So, but you moved to Chicago at some point, right around 78 or so?
I left in spring of 78. Okay. So if I said, right, I mean, yeah. Yeah, so I should say, I said I graduated with my degree. I believe my bachelor's degree says 78, because I was going, and I don't know if I should know this. now that I work here. But I was going to school concurrently in undergrad and graduate school. That's how I was a teaching assistant. Huh. So I was finishing up an undergrad, and there we go. I find now I remember. So it was spring of 78, and a lot of people decided they were leaving. And now I had been here in Champaign. I'd been here for 6 years. And now kind of my whole class, all of my peers, and all the guys I came up with, for whatever reason, seemed like we all arrived at the same place. We now needed to leave and move to a large city and continue playing. So there was a mass exodus. And not because no one loved Champaign being here. It was just time to move on. It just turned out that way. And it was like probably the biggest turnover, if I can remember, in Garvey's band. And that group of people would move to Chicago. We would earn a reputation quite quickly and start a big band called the Jazz Members Big Band. And we had everybody's attention, and it was within a year, and we had this band together. And guys who had been in Chicago, young players, older players, kept saying, "Who are these guys from Champaign? Did you hear about these guys that moved?" And they put a band together. "Have you heard these guys play?" And I think we all found out pleasantly, and to our surprise at times, everybody was, guys were sounding good and getting attention from some writers, radio people, and professional musicians in Chicago, kind of recognizing a group of new players, and they would say, "And by the way, we're from Champaign, Illinois." That kind of went along with it. We created a reputation in Chicago, and that reputation was that we were labeled we were from Champaign, Illinois.
So why Chicago versus going to New York? Or did a bunch go to New York as well?
Some people did. That would be Jim McNeely and John Burr. Now, John was originally a New Yorker from Huntington, Long Island.
But at that point, Chicago could sustain.
Yeah, there was a lot going on in Chicago. There was a lot you could get to get started. There were a lot of great gigs. The Rush Street still existed for commercial gigs and jazz gigs and 5 and 6 night a week gigs. And there on the corner of Rush and Walton was the Jazz Showcase. That was 6 nights a week. Every week, I mean, I don't know if the Jazz Showcase ever closed. I don't know, maybe Christmas night. Maybe. But the Jazz Showcase was there going 6 nights a week, and I mean every week was another name jazz artist. And I was just, early on, had an opportunity to work at the Jazz Showcase. But we got up there, we started a band, people started earning a reputation, and for me, within a handful of months, I was fortunate enough, Bunky Green heard me. So he's an incredible alto player who'd come up, played with Charles Mingus and a number of people. And John Campbell and I think at the time Steve LaSpina perhaps, and then eventually Kelly Sill, became Bunky's rhythm section in his group. But maybe probably one of the most important times, moments were right off real quick. This would have been 79. I had been in town for, I don't know, 5 or 6 months. There was a booking agent and a bar owner, I'll bring it this way, in Springfield, Illinois, at a club called the Crow's Nest. Here we go. And the Crow's Nest was a huge rock and roll club that now and then had jazz. And they were bringing Eddie Harris, the saxophonist, down there, and he needed a rhythm section. So she thought, this is now after we moved to Chicago, we weren't in Champaign. You guys could play with Eddie Harris. This wasn't too far. I'd only been in Chicago just for a while. Hey, this is a great gig. So John and Kelly and I now... We were playing some gigs with Bunky, and then we get called to play with Eddie Harris. That goes down.
And Eddie and Bunky were both in Chicago at that point, right?
Eddie was living in L.A., I want to say. He was in California. Okay. Bunky was in the Chicago area.
He was a Chicago guy, though, right?
Yes.
Originally.
Originally, yeah. So we had some gigs at the Jazz Showcase. Eddie asked us to play at the Jazz Showcase. Now, writers like Larry Cart and a couple other people heard about, there's these three young players that just moved to town. And they're starting to make the rounds, and they're starting to get calls. Well, it was a turnout. Joe had another gig come up, and it was with Eddie Jefferson. So we'd play a week. We played a week with Eddie Jefferson. We also, though, met Eddie Jefferson playing another gig downstate, I want to say in Bloomington, Illinois. They liked the way we played, so then we ended up working the Showcase. So we started falling into some of these really good gigs. And as it would turn out, and it's the only jazz video that I'm on and Campbell and Kelly that still sells throughout the world, and that's Eddie Jefferson and Richie Cole at the Jazz Showcase. At the time, that was recorded on my birthday, May 6th, 1979. I don't know if we've been in town 7 or 8 months, but we hit and we got some attention and we started working the Jazz Showcase. And that would open the door to the three of us and combinations of us working with numerous artists. And we started building a reputation. But I can't imagine doing it that way and with that success. And well, I mean this honestly, I can't imagine that happening or our talent being developed that well without Champaign Urbana, without the situation here.
Was Kelly still was in the Garve band too?
Kelly was in and out of the Garve band, not a lot. But Kelly was down here, and Kelly was, I'm trying to remember, a philosophy major. Started out as a math major. Okay. And for everybody who knows Kelly, the idea of math and philosophy fits him. That's for sure. He's an incredibly bright person. And Kelly, when I first met Kelly, that was early on, 72 or 73, and Kelly was basically playing rock and playing a Fender bass. And then he heard John Burr, and in college decided he wanted to get an upright bass and play jazz. Kelly basically learned to play jazz seemingly overnight.
So anyway. So Terry opens up the table in the fall of 79. By January of 80, he starts doing music. So you're already in Chicago. So how do you hear about the table and end up coming down here?
Well, where can I start? I mean, we're up there. We're starting to work quite a bit. We're still working as a trio. And at that time, I want to say before Nature's came up, but correct me if I'm wrong, there was a place on Green Street.
Zorba's?
Not Zorba's, but
Mabel's.
Mabel's.
He was doing jazz for
a little wonderful
while.
Club upstairs over Discount Records.
We did jazz for a little while, I think, at that period.
We started, it was at that point, and we were working, that was during our time with Eddie Jefferson and with Eddie Harris, and we booked a gig down here with Ron DeWarren. We played Mabel's.
And Ron was still...
Ron was still here in Champaign.
Okay.
And we thought it'd be great to return and play because there's such a great jazz audience here. Excuse me. So we got a couple of those gigs, and it seemed not long after I started hearing about there's this place that's a club. They have a liquor license. But here's how I learned about Nature's Table, and obviously the name, but they were a health food restaurant. That's how it was advertised to me. This was a health food restaurant. I thought, at the time, a health food restaurant that has jazz. I thought, well, they have a liquor license and they have beer. Okay. Not that this is how I measured what could be a place to play jazz, but I just wondered. And then I started hearing, there's quite an audience that comes out, and this is the new place, and they're attracting a lot of people. And I can't remember the first date other than in the time, but I believe it was John Campbell, Kelly Sill, myself, and Ed Peterson. Now, that was a group that also formulated in the early 80s, that was called Campbell's Group. And that was Kelly, myself, John, and Ed Peterson playing tenor. And we used to play a club on Monday nights called the Piano Man. Right on the corner of Clark and Waveland Avenue. Meaning when you walked out the door of the Piano Man and you looked across the street, there was the left field wall of Wrigley Field. Like right there. So anybody knows Chicago and Cubs Park, Wrigley Field, there we were, and that's where the Piano Man sat in the shadow. And I want to say we came down, that group was starting to work a lot, also working at a club called Orphans, and also when I first came to Chicago, John Campbell and I and Steve Lespino worked with Joe Daly, who was an incredible saxophonist and was a major name guy, and he heard us and he hired us. We were lucky. We had some luck. I mean, I thought we were playing well and all that kind of stuff, but the older guard heard us, and I don't know, whatever it was, took us under their wing. That would be Eddie Harris. That would have been Bonky. That would have been Joe Daly.
So you're getting all these gigs in Chicago. How is it worth... Was it worth it to come down here to play?
Well, I still had friends here. I still had connections. I still love the place. It wasn't that long that I'd left school. This place meant a lot to me. And I started hearing about this new club, Nature's Table. And I want to say, it was Campbell's Group that played Nature's Table. And I'm sure, I can't remember exactly the first time, but I know what happened. And that is, we came down and played, and an audience was there in true dramatic form, listening to every frigging note we played and really digging it. And it was like an event. And there was this audience that was really warm. And we thought, this is a great place to play. Now, that would be the beginning. As you know, you were there.
And of course, I wasn't there at the beginning.
Oh, you were? Okay. It was at this point that, of course, we met the owner and his wife. And that was Terry and Shelley. And as you might imagine, and anybody who met them, we liked them very much immediately. And they hooked up. They were obviously true artisans in their own right. They had a respect for art. They really, it was obvious, felt that this was valuable, that this is a valuable thing every day. It could be in the morning, the afternoon, nighttime. It's valuable to appreciate art, to interact with art, to interact with people, that it has everything to do with communicating and understanding people. And I always felt they were so clear about those kind of things. I know we all felt very comfortable, and they're very into having live music and the kind of music, hey, this is the way you play. It's one thing about Terry versus any other club owner practically ever met. He had no advice about what you should do and play and how it should be delivered.
He just said, do it.
And you know what? We felt like, and I mean, I've worked for club owners who were the other way, and I learned how to succeed and make a living. If you want to make a living as a musician. For a long time, I was a house drummer at Quilt Straw Boss at George's restaurant in Chicago, in the shadow of the Merchandise Mart. And George Podonsky, who I really admired, he was a tough-ass Chicago businessman who learned to succeed on many levels. He was my boss. He was very difficult to work for. But anyway, Terry was not difficult to work for. So there was that relationship, I thought, that came from them. You knew when you were there playing, there was this feeling everybody was open for whatever was to happen. So it was just great. And the groups also starting in the early 80s, who would we meet up with? None other than David Liebman. And Dave Liebman had just, by that point, had just come off of 5 years, I believe, with the Elvin Jones Group. And prior to that, of course, Miles Davis. We got together and started playing some clubs in Chicago. and it really clicked. And we thought we had something.
With Liebman.
With Liebman.
So he was kind of hanging out in the Midwest then for a while? Or?
No, he was in New York. But okay. We ended up, somebody booked us together in Chicago. Why? A new artist came, and we had surfaced as this trio. Oh, you're coming to town. You should call these guys. We kind of earned that, quote, that moniker. Our rep. And it wasn't long before we told Liebman, hey, Lieb, you know, are you familiar with Champaign-Urbana? And I don't know if he was or not. And then we said, well, this is Club Nature's Table. He says, well, where am I going to stay, man? What kind of bread does it pay? I mean, these are all important questions when you're making money as a musician. And we figured it out. And Liebman came and played Nature's Table, and it was absolutely burning. And all I can remember after one weekend, and, you know, Terry raised the price at the door, if you can believe it, at this time, I think he was charging $8 or $10 at the door.
That's outrageous.
I don't know if they want. I don't know if they want to do it now at the Iron Post. Wait a minute.
So here I found a flyer, 1982, May 4th, Dave Liebman with the John Campbell Trio. Not sure if that's the first one, but that's definitely.
That's got to be one of the first ones.
And then the Campbell Quintet with Ed Peterson, May 6th.
Oh, my birthday again. All these good gigs happen on my birthday.
And then the Campbell Trio, May 7th, so.
Yeah, we were so dang busy, and we hooked up, and I'll never forget we played here. Liebman just played his ass off, as always. The audience lost it. I can remember Liebman calling me up maybe or calling John up days later saying, hey, when can we get back down there? That was exactly his response. And that was it. Whenever he'd come to Chicago, well, we got to put a couple dates down in Champaign. Have you called Terry yet? It was like that. There's a guy who came up playing with Miles Davis and then Elvin Jones. Loved playing at Nature's Table.
And is that because of Terry, because of the listeners, because of just the whole thing?
Because of all of that. That's another thing I have to remark. You know, Terry was always working his ass off, and both he and Shelley, and they'd have the door, and Terry'd be over there taking the door, and we'd have a ton of people. And like any other club owner, and would have been honest, could have taken a portion of the door. They deserved to. That could be part of a deal. He never did. Those gigs could pay really good money for that time, for the early 80s. Playing jazz in a small club, the bread was damn good. And of course, Terry would feed you as a musician, and the food was great. But Terry was got to be very good friends with Terry. He's a very friendly sort. He was a guy that was very curious about art. You know, you want to become good at art. You want to be able to understand it. It takes part of that personality. It's okay to admit that you don't understand it. That would be the first step. I can just tell him his, and I think he certainly understood us, but I think he loved the club from the standpoint of having great musicians. I could tell he was getting a lot out of this artistically. It just wasn't like he was running a club and pulling down the bucks, pushing them in the cash register. And I mean, he had to do that. They owned the place. So they had to deal with that part of it. But he had a great empathy for art. And you felt like when you played there, I don't know how to put it. In terms, Campbell and I would talk about it. It's almost say like, what is it about this place? We almost kind of felt like we played our best. There was something, it was the environment. It was all an environmental thing. We'd end up looking forward to playing Nature's Table at times more than maybe playing the showcase. I don't know.
So I have to ask you, especially on some of the early flyers, which I know Shelley made, they call you Mole a lot on there. That was Joel the Mole Spencer.
Damn him. Well, as it turned out, I can tell you how that came. As a young player, I think I used to lean forward a little bit when I would play and kind of leaning over. And there was a jazz trumpet player here, played lead. And I haven't seen him in a long time, and I love this guy. Ken Ferrantino. He's a very humorous guy. Ken had the talent of giving everyone a nickname. Now, for example, and none of these necessarily could make sense, but one of my favorites was Eric Schneider was called Mr. Nippon.
Mr. what?
Nippon. There was a guy by the name of Jerry Tessin who played second trumpet in the big band, worked for the university. He was called Schmearman. He had nicknames. If you were within, you got to know Ken, somehow he would find something in your personality. He decided at some point, and we roomed together when I first moved down here, that I was the mole. And it stuck. Now, it was also partly because there was a swing drummer in the swing era. And maybe crossing the gap from what was maybe a New Orleans drummer into the swing period, and his name was Miff Mole. But I think my mole turned into M-O-E-L, and they removed the J. I don't know how thrilled I was about the mole, but there it was.
But yeah, Shelley has it all over some of the early flyers. So you kept on, so besides that band, so later on, I know it's not till like the mid-80s, you formed the Oregon Quartet.
Right, well that happened in 1984. That's because here since 19... earlier, Gino Campbell, John Campbell, the pianist, is from Bloomington, Illinois. And by the way, when I was still in college, I kept hearing from people, there's this piano player in Bloomington that you've got to hear. This kid can sound like Oscar Peterson. The guys were going on. Finally, I heard them, and they were right. An incredible talent. We played together when I was still in Champaign, but we really formed this group, you know.
Wait, he wasn't in the, didn't go to school here?
No, John did not go to school here.
Oh, okay.
John went to school at ISU in Bloomington.
I knew he was from Bloomington, but I thought he went to school here, so he didn't.
Okay. It didn't take him long once we started playing together, and that's one of our first groups we had was Kelly Sill and Carl Lidrell, myself and John Campbell. John coming over from Bloomington. And we used to play both towns. So I should go back. John and I did do a bunch of playing. That's how it kind of came together to begin with. But in 1984, and it was a great thing for him to do, I thought, what am I going to do? John decides he's going to move to New York. I thought, wow. And this was 1984, and he did. And there, I thought, well, here's a group I've been playing with for the last 5 years, and we've built this big reputation as a band, reputation as individuals. John's leaving. That's for us in the, you know, the immediate future. That's the end of the band I've been playing in, and that's the band that's been doing all this great work. So my immediate thought was, maybe it's time to start my own band. And I heard about this kid that was playing in Champaign, and I heard him at Nature's Table by the name of Mike Coker. And I thought, well, this kid can play. He sounds good. And he's still got only one more year of school to go. And just at that moment, Campbell's leaving. Well, because he's going to be leaving, he also owns a Hammond C3 organ with a Leslie speaker.
Campbell did.
Campbell. I just thought, I need to do something new and different. But part of my past and what I love about jazz was the whole Jimmy Smith, Don Patterson side of playing jazz. That is, the group with the walking bass line on the organ pad in the left hand and somebody playing that B3 with the Leslie speaker. I absolutely love that sound. So, John is selling, this is so funny. John says, I got to get rid of the C3. I'm not going to bring that to New York. It's just sitting in storage right now. I call Mike up when we had met and played together. He's a great guy. I thought, so I said, weeks come by, I said, Mike, what do you think about getting together and doing some playing together? I'm thinking of starting another group. I know you got another year of college to go. You know, would you be interested in putting something together and us playing? Well, all he did was hear us all the time with Campbell and myself. He was very interested. And then I said, but I'm interested in this, though. Have you ever played organ? He said, I've tried it some. Donnie Heitler used to have two Hammond organs. Mike had messed around. I said, look, man, want to start a group? Want to start working with me? Campbell wants to sell this organ. It's in great shape, and he's not looking. He just wants to get what he paid for it and get it back. By the way, this organ that I got to bring this up before I go any further belonged to the great Mel Ryan, the jazz organist from Milwaukee, who then sold it to great pianist David Hazeltine.
Wow.
Who works a ton in New York. He's got his own records out. He's done a lot of things with Louis Hayes on drums. A terrific player.
Mel Ryan played with Wes Montgomery.
That's right. The organ, and the Croker still owns the organ. Campbell bought it from David Hazeltine, and then
wow.
Croker, in these words, just says, you know what? This sounds great, playing together an organ group. This is the truth. Within a couple of weeks, he calls Campbell. He literally goes over there and agrees to buy the Hammond organ, and I now have a band. I have myself and an organ player. And then there's this young kid down here who's playing up a storm at the time, and that's Brad Wheeler. I decided, hence the new group, my new group called the Joel Spencer Trio, and it's with Brad and Mike playing Hammond organ. And we started playing some Chicago clubs, and that turned a lot of people around. They heard me now playing with this organ group and heard this young kid playing organ, who I think is one of the great natural talents of playing the Hammond organ. This guy was born to play that instrument. Now, I don't know if he wants to hear me say that, because he's a great piano player, but I never missed, honest to God, having a bass player when Mike was playing Hammond. Never missed it. He had the accuracy, the musicality, the time, the precision, just in the pocket and at burning tempos, and he played the organ. He was born to play that instrument. He was an absolute natural. And it went on from there, and all boasting aside, eventually I'd add a guitarist, Akio Sasajima, and some of our bigger gigs. We'd play in the Chicago Jazz Festival and play to 250 cities live. We had some very big gigs, but it got to the point where we had really played that group out and played a ton of gigs, and I was just ready for something else. It didn't end in any bad vibes or anything, but that was a wonderful time. That was a wonderful band.
And you played frequently at the table.
We played a lot at the table. There was a club called Oz up on Sheffield. I'll bet for a year and a half or so, he had us play there once a month, 2 weeks a month, four nights each week. We played 8 gigs a month at Oz. We picked up other gigs around town in Chicago. We did some traveling. It was fun. Mike was so into it, he went out and bought a brand new Chevy Astro van with the seats out of it, like a cargo van, had ramps. And he had the Hammond dollies on the equipment. We had a whole system of pushing that organ in and out of clubs, up the ramps, in the truck, fastened them with the rest of the equipment, and we were on our way. That band did have a lot of equipment. And that band was together basically 1984 through 1988. But I became very busy during the mid-late 80s working at George's, and I told you about George Bodansky. George's was an incredible restaurant showroom that had some of the greatest talents in the music business. So I worked from everybody from a Billy Eckstine to a Ruth Brown to Wayne Shorter to Woody Shaw to Lou Donaldson.
And you were the house drummer?
I was a house drummer. Sissy Houston, Whitney Houston's mom, who came up with a group in the 60s, the Sweet Inspirations, after she then went and with the rest of Elvis's career was the lead singer in his female vocal group on his show, on his road show. I worked with her a ton. I worked with a ton of people at George's. And I was back, you know, on my own. And there were times I'd hire a bass player or just be me. And certainly with singers, they bring in their own piano player. But that was an amazing gig. It might be, as far as being a musician, you know, playing in a steady gig, guys would come in and tell me, you got the greatest gig in America. You got the greatest. Nobody has a gig like this.
You said it was right by the Merchandise Mart?
Right. It was on Kinsey and Franklin. And when you walked out the corner, right across the street was the Merchandise Mart. But that was like this gargantuan, you know, incredible size building that you felt, you know, obviously like you were the size of a fly.
Is the space still there? Or is it torn down?
It is. The space is still there. It's a restaurant. It's all a dream. It's all a memory. I used to work there with Dakota Staton. I worked there with a bunch of great singers. I worked there with, was one of my favorite, Billy Daniels. In the 40s had a hit on Old Black Magic. I got to work with pianist from Vegas, Ron Foyer. Used to come through there. And I worked at another club at the Holiday Inn and a club called Rick's Cafe Americana. So I was blessed. There was a moment for about 3 years. I had the drum chair at both clubs, which were the two clubs that competed with the showcase. And a lot of the nights worked out. I was able to coordinate them, and I was the drummer at those two clubs.
I think, and I know I only printed out some of these things, because you played a lot. You played, came down and played with Lawrence Hobgood a few times too, right? Weren't you doing some?
Oh yeah, well I knew Lawrence here in town as a student in the music department. It's also aware that his dad was a professor here. I was here and coming up, I know he had some good gigs and booked a lot of things with Carl Liddrell. And for a while he had a group. We certainly did some playing together. Oh yeah. And of course he moved up to Chicago and then the hookup with Kurt Elling.
So, do you remember, as time went on, what some of maybe the last gig or so you played at the table was? Because it went till spring of 91.
Yeah, the organ group was over by, I think I said 88 into 89. That was probably it. I would say my last gigs at Nature's Table probably the late 80s.
And what band do you think that would have been?
I think that would have been my own band. I think that would have been the organ group.
The organ group, okay.
I think that was... And if I was town playing, you know, playing somewhere else, whenever that happened, I would certainly go over there. And of course, when did Nature's close?
May of 91.
It said May of 91. I can remember hearing about that and thinking, wow, it's an end of an era. There were a ton of incredible memories. And I can remember that time coming to town to work with somebody. And Nature's Table, the building, had disappeared. And that was weird. It wasn't like it... I didn't see it like it when it was an empty building. I saw it when
They tore it down within a month or two.
Oh, did they? I didn't know what the timetable.
After we turned over, they filmed a little documentary, like WILL did, and we got the call, and me and Terry and a few people were sitting on the grass of Cranert with like a 12-pack old style, as they came by and were knocking it down.
Yeah.
So it was an empty parking lot before, like for a few years, but it didn't sit vacant for long.
Well, that was in prime real estate. That's the other thing. The Nature's Table stood out. Although they had Thunderbird up the street, they had Trino's. It was just interesting, this little place with that wood paneled front and the sign above and through the door, and you just never knew what happened. Now, one thing I forgot to mention, and I would tell people, I said, that are going to play there, and guys we're going to bring down, and so on. I said, you're not going to believe it, because the owner's wife is a professional dancer. She went to school in dancing, and they're serious artistic free-form dancers, as well as, quote, legitimate. I'm sure when they were young, they tap danced, they did ballet, all the things a dancer, I would imagine, does. But I said, there could be any moment when the spirit moves our dance troupe, and there could be, I said, it's like Woodstock. Woodstock comes to the Nature's Table. And guys, I would tell them this, and they'd go, right, and they'd laugh. Then they'd come back, and I'm trying to remember. They'd say, man, some dancing broke out. It was unbelievable. There must have been 15, 16 people just free-form dancing to what we were playing. Said, I never saw anything like that. I said, you've been to Nature's Table. I wasn't lying.
Did you ever play with Lynn Halliday at all?
Yes. And I can remember the first time I saw Lynn. I don't know the way he appeared to me. Of course, we know Lynn, and we would know. When I tell you what this is, you're probably going to think, oh, come on. It's true, though. I saw Lynn, and he was sitting, I think, probably with one of the younger players and sitting at a table. I thought that was that kid's dad. It was the impression, and his dad was there to hear him play. What did I know? Then the next thing, I see this guy getting out a saxophone. And I'm thinking, oh boy. And I'm wondering, you know, I don't know what a jazz musician is supposed to look like. But there was Lynn. And he got his horn out. And he sounded like Sonny Rollins or somebody. Like this intense voice from a hard bop era. Playing in this style that's so true to the code, with this great sound and these, obviously, for lack of a better word, these incredible professional, super mature jazz lines that sound, I almost had to adjust and thought, well, my God, who is this? Then to find out, I had never heard of Lynn Halliday, who is this musician, this player, who a lot of people in the industry knows from the past, was in New York, played on Maynard's band, knew Miles Davis, played gigs with Philly Joe Jones, and it just went, and finally I got to meet him and so on and so forth, to find out he knew Ira Sullivan, Red Rodney. Well, he was just one of the cats, but I'd never heard him. Well, like I said, the first time I heard him, I just didn't know who he was, and no one even announced him. No one was really paying any attention to him.
Was this at the table, or was it up in Chicago?
This was at the table. Yeah. And he was just sitting over in the corner with some people, and he got a horn out, and I just thought, well, I wonder who this guy is. And it was this guy who's uniquely so authentic, and I thought, this guy's a real jazz player. This guy's this gifted musician. I was blown away. And then I talked to him, and of course, he had this very thick southern accent. And it was charming and extremely friendly and extremely humble. And I told him how much I liked his playing. He just said, aw, I'm just trying to play. I can't play. Then he says, you know, you should have heard me about 10 or 15 years ago. And he could have been right. And then eventually I learned that once, like I said, all these great players knew who he was. And he was this guy at one time who was really coming up there. And it was a force to be reckoned with. That's what I think I started learning, and there were others. Who knows who could show up at Nature's Table? After a while, it's like, I guess we wouldn't be surprised to, you know, who would ever walk through the door. Well, they heard about it, decided to stop in. They might be real famous, yeah. I think it built a reputation. I think the table, I mean, everyone certainly enjoyed it. It was this place to go, and not only to play, but for musicians, I'd love to go there just to hear what was happening next, to hear young players that were here, that come here that I didn't know, and checking them out. There was a real commitment. When people got on, quote, the bandstand at Nature's Table, people were expecting you to play well. You know, So I don't mean to be going on so long here, but I think that's when Nature's Table, for me as a musician, came into its own. You know, besides all the great personalities and friendships, the place had established itself to a point where I honestly felt when we play there, it was a commitment. You were playing at Nature's Table, and you realized there were a lot of great, really great players, young, talented players who had played there. There was a vibe. Every time I played Nature's Table, I thought it brought, and for everyone, I thought it brought the best out of us. So, I mean, needless to say, when it went, like so many others, I missed it. And for a long time, I didn't find myself coming back to Champaign to play. And of course, I wondered, and I know some of the answers. I think a lot of people thought, well, all we have to do is just find another space, and there can be Nature's Table again. Help, with the same sign on the front. I don't know. But it never happened. You'd know more about that than me.
People tried. Terry tried.
Mm-hmm.
I tried. But finding the space was hard to, because it was so crucial, right across from Cranor, up the block from the music school.
Did you guys try to get, I'm sure, something in that neighborhood at first?
We tried. But, I mean, the lunch business is what sustained the music. Because there'd be nights, I remember later when the Garve Band was on Tuesday nights up at Trino's, and I'd be working Tuesday at the table, and there'd be great music, but there'd be like 10 people.
Yeah.
Yeah. Doc Scott.
There you go. There's another persona. I think it exists, right? I think I've seen it, a lineup of everybody, or somebody has tried to collect all the names that have played there. Yeah.
We tried. We've been working on some of the schedules and stuff, so.
Yeah, that was definitely a moment. I mean, is there a collection of, like, quote, name artists who played there that were, you know, quote, famous?
Kind of. I mean, we kind of have a schedule. It's a work in progress.
Mm-hmm.
We run out of time and energy at times.
So. Yeah.
Helgeson has a list of a bunch of the bands that played there from schedule. We need to collect more schedules, though. We have gaps. But
God, Helgeson, I can remember the groups those guys put together. You know, that was the younger set. Those are the guys that were coming up after me. Some really good playing. I mean, there has been a tradition of jazz playing in Champaign, as I started out with. And Nature's Table became a big part of that. There were places and guys seriously playing here, and then there was just another venue, but it turned out to be really special.
Well, that sounds like a good ending point.
Hey, that was fun, man.
Thanks, Joel.
Thank you. I enjoyed that very much.